You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday, the 13th. Time for our reporter roundtable, and this is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our region this last week. Our panel today, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side, and Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I want to start with some news from our universities. All the university presidents of our four-year public universities came out and said they will not be asking for tuition increases this year. And Mike, over at KIVI, you guys recently did a story about the reasons behind tuition costs at our universities.
Right. So I, every once in a while, just drown myself in numbers.
Because why not?
I just really had a great time yesterday digging in. And I started noticing some interesting trends. I was covering the State House in 2009 and then 2010 when those massive cuts started coming in. And I remember interviewing, you know, Senator Dean Cameron, who was chair of JFAC at that time, and the pain that they had in hacking these budgets. And so I went back and I looked, I compared 2009. 2009 was the last fiscal year before those massive cuts. It went from like $422 million for higher ed to like $390 the next year, $370, $320. And so I decided to kind of like trace where that funding went after. It's very numbers heavy, but I feel like looking at the numbers, you can see why, at the very least, why students are carrying more of the burden. Mm. It doesn't answer the question about why tuition and why education has skyrocketed at the rate it has, but it does tell you why students are picking up that piece. So for instance, 2009 to 2020, looking at the two fiscal budgets, it went up $423 million to $604 million in total funding for colleges and universities. So it looks good. Mm-hmm. Right? It increased. That's a 43% increase. But the money from tuition went from $129 million to $281 million. So that's a 118% increase in that time. And in that time, the money from the state to fund higher education went up 10%. It went up $294 million to $323 million. It took like 7 years just to get to the same level of budget as they were sitting at in 2009. So it shows after they made those cuts, budgets started receiving more of those funds. But higher ed didn't really. And so in order to keep up with higher enrollment and becoming a research university and hiring new professors and building new programs, they raised tuition. And that's pretty much across the board. Boise State, University of Idaho, Idaho State, LCSE. And I mean, even tracing back, I mean, it's not apples to apples anymore looking at this university. But just looking at 1980 and seeing that tuition was $20.
Right.
Just – that just made my credit loan balance just cry. It's remarkable to see just it, – it's not just that it's increased because, of course, I mean, with inflation, I did adjust it for inflation. That tuition would be $62. So it's not direct, right? $62, still pretty cheap.
In this day and age, that's
right,
still
right.
Really cheap.
Yeah.
Right. So, Nicole, you've been looking into education here in Idaho, but looking really into the inequity of it. So your second installment in this series just published. So talk to us about your findings.
Yeah, the Idaho Statesman and Idaho Education News, we have this year-long project. We've been on to talk about it before.
Yeah.
Just looking at the significant gaps that are facing Latino students in Idaho. It's one of the it's not only is one of the state's largest minority groups, but they make up a significant number of Idaho's student population. We're talking about almost one in every five kid in Idaho schools is Latino, and white students outperform Latino students in this state by almost every metric. We're talking 30-point gaps when it comes to scores on standardized tests. Which
30-point gaps?
Yeah. There's some pretty significant gaps, percentage point gaps, mm-hmm. when it comes to how well these students are doing. So we kind of, in our first installment, we looked at what's happening here, why is this important, and of course the reason that it's important is the state is going through a demographic change. It's not going to be, you know, huge and immediately, but these students are going to be a significant part of our workforce, of our community, and for the same reason that we want all kids in public schools to be well-educated and prepare for life in our state, same thing that we're looking at for Latino students. So most school districts have a fairly significant gap. In fact, most school districts that have a large portion of Latino students have this gap where there's, you know, whether it comes to English language learners or you know, anything else, they're falling behind their peers. There's very few school districts, though, that have called it what it is and are taking aggressive steps to try to combat that at every level. So we went up to the Blaine County School District in Haley and Ketchum, and it was really interesting to see some of the things that they're doing, whether changing their English language curriculum around English language learning curriculum so that there's more co-teaching. You have students in the same classroom instead of separated away from their peers and, you know, being taught by a teacher assistant. You know, they of course do have a dual immersion program, which, you know, some other school districts do as well, that has, you know, significant impacts. But a lot of the things they're doing is just culture change. You know, the Blaine County School District went through an immense demographic change in the last 10 years. They're now at 42% Latino students up there.
Really?
Yes. And of course, Blaine County is also one of the most unequal counties in the state of Idaho, you know,
in the nation.
In the nation, you know, you have people going to school with the same kids, you know, whose parents have mansions, you know, up in the Wood River Valley.
And when we say mansions, we mean
multiple mansions. Multiple. Yes. And then you have, you know, the workforce that has to find a place to live often outside the valley, but their kids are still going to school there. And it's just a very different set of circumstances. Mm. And of course, one of the reasons we took a look at this is because we don't know yet if these changes that they're implementing are going to have a significant impact. You know, there some changes have happened. You know, there's more Latino students involved in advanced placement courses than, you know, they've really closed the gap on that. But it's still early, and it's still something that's going to take some time, but it matters immensely to these kids and to our state, honestly, because these are the kids that we want to stay in Idaho and to contribute. And if they're a significant portion of our population divided along racial lines is not doing as well, it's really important to take a look and find out why.
So that is published in both the Statesman and Idaho Ed News.
Yes, you can find it on both of our websites right now.
And Rebecca, I want to bring you into the conversation and talk about a story that you did this week. And this is regarding a new federal report finding that the number of kids who say they have been sexually victimized in juvenile detention centers has dropped across the United States. But that's not necessarily good news.
Right. And it's an improvement, but it's not a great story
right.
still. So the numbers were from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is part of the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Justice. And under a law called the Prison Rape Elimination Act, they gather a lot of data every handful of years on what's going on in prisons and jails and juvenile detention centers and other residential juvenile facilities. And they kind of do it on a rolling basis. So this new one that just came out this week was on sexual victimization in juvenile detention centers. And what they did was they did anonymous surveys or interviews I think off the top of my head, it was like more than 6,000 kids that are in more than 330 juvenile detention facilities or residential centers across the U.S., right? So that's not every center.
Mm-hmm.
It's not every kid. But it was enough that they feel like they could get a real good sample of what's going on. And they asked them about a wide spectrum of forced or coerced sexual contact or behaviors, right? So ranging from rape to things like unwanted touching or even being shown pictures or movies of a sexual nature. And victimization that was done by other residents or student, you know, kids at the facilities or by staffers. So it really covered a wide spectrum of behaviors. And what they found is nationally, about 7.1% of kids reported being sexually victimized during the previous 12 months. That's a lot of kids.
That's not a small number.
But it is a drop compared to the last time the survey was done in 2012, when 9.5% of kids reported this. The other thing that this survey does, that these federal researchers do, is that they look at – they make a list of the facilities of just the ones that they looked at, right, because it's not every facility, that have the highest reported rates of sexual victimization and also the lowest. And Idaho was interesting because it ended up on both lists. So – the Juvenile Correction Center in Lewiston had a 0% report. So none of the kids up there reported that they had been sexually victimized within the last 12 months. Now, there's a standard of error, like there is in a report. But so they ended up on the best list, right? But the Juvenile Correction Center in St. Anthony ended up on the worst list, with almost 13% of kids reporting that they had been sexually victimized within the last
year. So that's way above even what the national average.
That's way above the national average.
I mean, almost double.
Right. And again, we don't have the granular data to know what kind of behaviors they were reporting had occurred. Okay? So we don't know. But we do know that this is a study that's been done before. They do it on a broad scale in multiple facilities across age spectrums. So the Bureau of Justice Statistics is pretty confident in their numbers. I talked to Monty Pro, who is the director of the Idaho Department of Juvenile Corrections. He said they were surprised, very surprised by the findings. Not surprised by the Lewiston findings. They expected that. But the fact that St. Anthony ended up on this high rate of sexual victimization list, they did not expect that. He said that they have been doing everything that's required under PREA, that Prison Rape Elimination Act, to make sure those kids are safe and that they can report harm. And they've even gone above and beyond that. So they don't know how these numbers came to be, but they are looking into it. And Monty Pro says if there's anything that they can learn from this on how to do better, they will.
That's a huge number. I mean, that's just the fact that it is almost double from what this national survey found.
Right.
So they will, I'm assuming, not just look into it, but maybe change some practices?
Well, first they have to figure out what practices to change by looking at the data. So I think they were going to try to get more information from the Department of Bureau of Justice Statistics. And this is not the only report that's going to come out. The Bureau of Justice Statistics has a lot of information and a lot of really granular data. This is just kind of the summary.
The overview.
So I talked to some of the researchers there, and they said we have more information. It's going to be coming out in the coming months. We just don't have it ready yet. And that's going to include rates of sexual victimization, hopefully among LGBTQ kids who traditionally have been at a much higher risk of being sexually assaulted or abused in detention facilities and other lockup scenarios.
Our panel today, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Rebecca, there was a new survey that came out, I believe you said, by those State Department of Education, youth risk survey?
Right. So it was developed in conjunction with the CDC, right? And they do it all over the place. But the Department of Ed does it here. And what they do is they survey kids in like 9th grade through 12th grade across the state. And they ask them about risky behaviors that they might be engaging in or have engaged in the past. And so that runs, smoking, having sex, getting bullied on campus, all sorts of things. And they ask them about all of this stuff. And so some of the results were really encouraging, right? We have fewer kids than previously. The survey's done, I think, every 2 years, say that they were bullied on campus.
So that number has gone down.
So that's good. That's gone down. Smoking cigarettes has also gone down. I think vaping, however,
has gone up.
Right? Fewer kids are reporting that they're having sex. So that's gone down. But the number of kids who have seriously considered suicide remains at a 10-year high, which is very scary. So they looked at they included more than 1,200 high school students in 45 schools across the state, right? Nearly 40% of those kids reported that they feel sad or hopeless. And 22% reported that they'd seriously considered suicide. That's the same numbers that we had in 2017, and it's the highest in the past decade.
Well, and we have an epidemic in the state of Idaho when it comes to youth suicide. I mean, we do. And so, Mike, I'm interested in a story that you've done about Instagram getting in on mental health and kids.
Right. So it actually started with the survey that happened, I believe, in 2017. When we were going through those numbers, we found that like 9% of students said that they had attempted suicide, not even just thoughts. We're talking nearly 10% had made an attempt on their own life. And so we started looking at some of the things surrounding mental health of youth. One of the things that just keeps coming up, no matter who you talk to, is social media. Social media is part of the world now. We were talking about it off the air. It's part of the way these kids are growing up. Instagram trying to at least publicly make an effort to show that they're cutting back on the effects on kids, at least the negative effects, has removed likes. Well, you can like posts, but you can't see how many posts or how many likes other posts have. And the goal of that was to make it so that there was less of a comparison between people, so that people weren't measuring themselves in that way. when in reality they continue to measure themselves that way, they can still see the amount of likes. Other people can't, but they're still watching. They're still refreshing. And separately from that, you know, we talked to a couple experts, and what they said was, you know, the effects of social media, the negative effects go so far beyond likes. It's about this carefully curated world that the children are living in, where they are a lot of times receiving messages, subliminal messages in a lot of ways that are negative, including just the fact that kids these days are naturally comparing themselves in a very unhealthy way to the way other people are living. It doesn't matter how many likes you see on your friend's post, but if your friend always looks happy and is always at the beach and you're sitting in negative 10 degree temperatures and you're miserable, you're going to say, wait, why don't I live that life? Mm-hmm. And that's so common, and that's not going away. So these experts are saying continue to monitor your kid's online presence. I don't know if anybody saw, oh, Instagram likes are going away. I guess my kid can just hang out on the phone all day.
Right.
Like, no, I doubt there were a ton of parents who were just letting the leash off. However, the negative effects are still there. They're still very, very real.
Well, and you think about it, right? Even as adults, you feel that sometimes. And I think that we are highly aware of it. We are intelligent individuals. But there are still those times when there are certain people that come up on your feed that it's not even the happy. It's almost the lifestyle in a way. And I know that I've gotten rid of certain people on things just because it doesn't feel good.
Right.
So, and, you know, my frontal lobe is developed. So, right?
Yeah.
So you go back and you think about kids, and then this report comes out, Rebecca, and I think it is so stressful for parents when these reports come out and the numbers continue to go up. They're not even stabilizing.
Right. I mean, and what is the solution? I mean, when you talk about it, you can have these reports, you can have this qualitative data that show this is a real problem. But it remains true that the tools that children can use to hurt themselves are often just in the house.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about traditional weapons and things that are a main focus and should be for parents, but it's medications. It's knives that you have in the kitchen. There are so many different things. And we've had these conversations as part of our Finding Hope series with experts about giving parents the tools that they need to protect their children while not giving ideas to children on the tools that are out there. Mm-hmm. And it's a delicate balance. It's really, really hard.
And I think that's the key, though, is that I think there is an assumption sometimes that if you're a parent, you actually know what you're doing. And I think as parents, we need help too to know how to move through these, especially different phases of childhood.
Right. And I think one of the important things to note is a lot of times when you're watching your children grow up and you're trying to monitor their growth, you perceive the differences that they're experiencing as external. And it's important to note that they're also physiological. Like their brains are different,
right?
Because of the environment that they're growing up in, and so this is not going to end when they become adults. Their brains are going to grow in a different way than ours did, and they've got to cope with that. That's why these coping mechanisms are so important. Is you can take their phones away and pretend like social media is not a thing, but guess what? When they're outside of the home, they're going to be coping with these things, and they're probably going to be even more serious 15, 20 years down the road.
So this Finding Hope series, Mike, you can find it on your website, because I know you're doing an entire—
Right. You can find all of our Finding Hope stories. A lot of them are done by Karen Lair. Over the last 2 years, we focused on addiction and mental health. And if you search Finding Hope, it'll bring up just a whole list of stories.
And I want to shift gears, and because, Nicole, the U.S. House passed the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. So what does this potentially mean for farm workers here, I guess, across the country, but here in Idaho?
Here in Idaho, it's, it just passed the House, still has to go through the Senate and, you know, all of the other hurdles.
All the rigmarole that comes along with
yeah,
it.
Yeah. And, it's fairly controversial in many circles, not so much in the farm industry because of how needed it is. But the bill does a lot of things. But one of the main things that it does is that it provides a path to legal status for farm workers, and specifically for farm workers who have been working in the United States for a significant amount of time and who will commit to working a further, I can't remember the exact number of years, but, you know, part of this agreement would be you would have to say, I'm going to work in the farm labor industry for 5 to 6 years. I can't remember the exact number, but it could have a huge impact. I believe the nationwide, it's about 1 million people could be affected by this. And in Idaho, that will be a significant effect too, because we have a lot of farm workers who are working here without authorization just by the fact of unemployment is very low. And it is very hard, and there are many other jobs that are available to you if you have legal status and don't have to worry about things like that.
So this could make a significant difference.
It could. And some of the other things that the bill does is also is going to have a very big impact on Idaho as well. Most significantly, it makes a lot of changes to the H-2A program, which is for temporary foreign workers from Mexico who come and work for a certain period of time. That is, it's going to make a lot of streamlining changes because it is a very complicated federal process right now. But also, it's going to open it up to dairies who have not had access to this program before and have really had a hard time getting workers and retaining them, and have, of course, been some of the loudest advocates for immigration reform because they want to be able to hold on to the workers that they have now that may be working with kind of shaky legal status while also have an opportunity in the future to reach out to this H-2A program, keep their dairies alive, which is – You know they're pushing into automation a lot right now here in Idaho because there are so few workers available. It's a hard job. Not everyone wants to do it.
Rebecca, I want to talk to you about an update with the prisons. Talk to us about their execution secrecy rules.
Right. So, you know, everybody's rules expired last year in state agencies, and they all have been working on it. So this actually happened a little earlier this year, but it didn't really get a lot of attention at the time because we're all focused on the rules that they were changing on their security cameras or that they had talked about changing and then ended up, I think, rethinking that a little bit. But this is on secrecy surrounding the source of the state's lethal injection drugs. So this has been a long ongoing fight in Idaho and in other states that have lethal injection executions, right? It's hard to find those drugs. You know, big pharmaceutical companies don't give those drugs to prison company or to prison industry anymore because they don't want them used for executions. So it's a really short, small supply. And Idaho prison officials have said in the past, like, if we have to reveal who our suppliers or potential suppliers are of these lethal injection medications, we could lose those suppliers and not be able to carry out our legal duty under state law to execute people who have been condemned to death and have run out of their appeals. Right. So for them, that's the stakes. However, for people like University of Idaho professor Lisa Cover, who has sued under the public records law to get access to that information because she researches it and believes that it should be released, they want the info. So there's this ongoing battle, and that's the backdrop here. Mm-hmm. So what the state did, the Department of Correction and the Board of Correction this summer, is they, in the process of going through their rules, they updated the rule so that it forbids the department from disclosing under any circumstance information that the department director, in this case, Josh Tewalt, determines could jeopardize the department's ability to carry out an execution. Now, that's been around for a long time. But this time, they specifically added language that forbids the release of information that could potentially identify both the past and future suppliers of lethal injection drugs or even other materials that might be used during the process of an execution.
But how does that work when we have this lawsuit going on? Because that might not, a judge may not think the same thing.
Right. So it's not clear what the department means by under any circumstances, right? Does that mean
too bad
defiance
a judge
of a judge's
said?
Order or, you know, if such an order should exist? Now, Eliza Cover, the professor, has she largely won. It wasn't a complete win, but largely won at the lower court level. And that case is now being appealed by the department to the Idaho Supreme Court, which will probably take it up this coming year.
Mm-hmm.
So we could have another ruling coming up sometime in the next several months on whether the department has to release this information or not.
So then I would assume it doesn't really matter that they put this new verbiage in place if the Supreme Court rules in a different way.
Well,
who knows?
I think you get into a separation of powers issue there. I don't know. This is an administrative rule.
Okay.
They sort of carry the force of state law, but they are not specifically state law.
This is fascinating.
A judge's order is a judge's order. I don't know how that would shake out. Right. But suffice it to say, it is pretty interesting and we should just probably keep watching.
Suffice it to say, we will probably find out.
Yeah.
I want to thank all of you for coming in on this Friday. I love the Reporter Roundtable. Thank you so much for getting us updated. Our panel today, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, and Mike Sharp with KIVI6 on your side. Always good to have you guys in here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Up next, we are going to be having a conversation with the former House Minority Leader, Matt Erpelding. This is Idaho Matters.